This is the Education Gadfly Show.
You dress a lot like the Occupy Wall Street people.
I would go hang with them.
Flip-flops, shorts, you'd fit right in.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, straight from Wall Street, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey.
So, Rick, were you part of the protest, or were you trying to quell the protests?
No, man, I'm with the protesters. I'm particularly excited about their new income redistribution plan.
Yes.
The one where bankers make 20K, doctors make 28, and government employees make 33.
Mm-hmm. But I will say that the way you dress a lot like the Occupy Wall Street people usually dress.
I would go hang with them.
Flip-flops, shorts, you'd fit right in.
I hear they got like food. They got people out there on the hibachis whipping it up.
Nice. You know, Rick and I were coming back from Capitol Hill today in a taxi cab. By the way, I wanted it to be known that I took the Metro on the way there. But Rick was going back by cab, so I figure, the carbon footprint of me joining him was very small. So, and we drove past the Occupy Washington demonstration, and I don't know, I think I counted about 6 protesters, was it?
It was pretty sparse.
Pretty sparse, yeah.
You know, it's like when the teachers did their march on Washington,
yes.
And there's, 50,000 teachers in the metro accessible metropolitan area?
Yeah.
And maybe 5,000 showed up for their big march?
Right. Yeah, you know, protests just aren't what they used to be. I mean, I think people, you know, it's in the age of Netflix and, people just like to stay home.
People tweet their support.
Yeah, exactly, which means so much. All right, Rick and I have been away for the last couple of weeks. You've enjoyed the opinions, the passion, the arguments of Janie and Daniela. And now we take back the microphones. Daniela, back in the questioner chair. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Question number one. Earlier this week, Senator Tom Harkin announced a middle-line ESEA proposal. Are lefty education folks getting run over, and should we celebrate this?
So, making sense of the Harkin proposal is a little tough, not only because we haven't read it yet, but my understanding is that it's, on accountability, it definitely is a real rollback on No Child Left Behind. It gives this, for the most part, back to the states in much the same way that Senator Alexander's bill that came out a few weeks ago did, in much the same way that President Obama and Arne Duncan's waiver plan does. I mean, everybody seems to be in agreement that we need to give this back to the states and have these fights over accountability at the state level. Everyone in agreement except for these lefty reform groups and civil rights groups. And yeah, as you know, look, if they don't have Harkin, Democratic senator, I think they've been rolled. Is that right, Rick?
I don't know about being rolled. I mean, I think this is this is a play we've seen before. When Reagan was really gearing up in 79 and 80 and was running against AFDC and was running against welfare reforms, running against the 60 Great Society legacy, you had these, very liberal, very activist groups calling for, no retreat on the role of Washington, facing off against kind of centrist Democrats and Republicans. And I think what's happened is now with Bush administration gone, it's become clear that the only people really excited about a lot of the invasive parts of NCLB are, activist lefty groups who, got more power to them. I'm sure they think what they're doing is helpful, but they realize that the vast majority of people aren't really in favor of having Washington try to micromanage school improvement across the land.
You know, and there's two ways, there's two parts of this argument, right? One is the federal role, and should we have these debates in Washington or state by state? And the second is, when you get into the details of accountability, should the accountability system be trying to change the political realities on the ground and try to say that, hey, we need to make poor and minority kids a higher priority than they otherwise would be? The basic assumption is that, left to their own devices, states and districts will continue to give the most resources, the best teachers, the most challenging curriculum to the affluent kids, and that the poor and minority kids will get screwed. So you have to decide, do you believe that that's a fair assessment? And number two, do you think that a federal intervention can change that dynamic? And, I wish we could have the conversation so openly that that's what we're really fighting about. But I don't really hear that at the end of the day. So you look at it by that way and you say, okay, so then it does make sense that the civil rights groups, believe that this law is helping poor minority kids from getting as screwed as they otherwise would.
Mm-hmm.
But that they don't have the politics on their side. They don't. They haven't made this case to the rest of the country.
And this is partly their own fault. This is what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks on the achievement gap stuff, on your high flyer report, is, they've made a very conscious choice in my mind for the past decade to make school reform about redistribution. you know, in the most recent PDK Gallup stuff this summer, 79% of Americans gave the kid their oldest child attends an A or a B. 4% gave their school a D or an F. The advocates of highly invasive, highly prescriptive NCLB have really tried to build their coalition around that 4% that hates their school. And they're not offering a lot in terms of broad school improvement to middle class or suburban parents or voters. And now they're reaping what they've sown, which is most Americans aren't for the agenda they're putting forward.
Okay, topic number two.
Governor Jerry Brown, staunch opponent to standardized testing, turned heads when he vetoed an update to California's API testing system. Did he make the right call?
So this was very interesting this week, and reading his veto statement was fascinating. This is Jerry Brown, you know, at his best, at his worst, as his loopiest, as his most profound. I don't know. I mean, he basically said, look, that there was an effort. It sounds like, you know, a fairly broad based effort to try to improve the API system to include indicators other than just student achievement, and to, you know, which you could, you know, argue is a thoughtful thing to do. To say, hey, you know, if schools are going to respond to pressure from accountability, let's make sure that we're measuring more than just test scores. He said basically he didn't want to have the law pass because that would then make it look like we've solved this problem. He wants to blow up the system instead. And he said some things that make some sense, I think. Well, Rick, what's your take on this?
You know, I mean, I know very little about you just explained more than I actually know about what's unfolding in California on this. But you know, I mean, I think, right, both positions make sense. I mean, it sounds like it's a microcosm of the NCLB conversation, that lots of us are frustrated with kind of the status quo, but from two directions. There's some people who say, my God, we need to double down. We need better tests, stronger tests. We need to be more comprehensive, but tests are the right response. Mm-hmm. And then there's others who say, we need to broaden out. We need multiple measures. Ideally, we want to de-emphasize testing, kind of the Ravitch brigades. And, you know, what's interesting is people have talked about this, you know, peculiar alliance, say, of the right and of the NEA on some of the proposals for ESEA rollback. And I think what you're seeing in Washington, and it sounds like what you're seeing in California, is that some of the folks who have real concerns with the testing apparatus from different sides of the political spectrum wind up voicing similar concerns. And what that plays out, if because he wants to blow this up, you wind up keeping API. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a quite ironic outcome.
You know, I feel like we have so much confusion about how to talk about these policies without ending up preferencing one kind of school over another, right? So people who want something more progressive, say like the Waldorf school that my son goes to, you know, say we hate testing, we hate these accountability policies because their sense is these are policies that would hurt their kinds of schools or make their kinds of schools impossible. And they're not necessarily wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you see the way people talk about these things. It's that people want different kinds of schools. And how can we find a way to make sure there is that kind of plurality with our system, that if certain people want something more loosey-goosey, they can get it, and somebody wants something more, you know, tiger mom-ish, they can have that within this framework where there's still some kind of accountability to the public, that the money's being well spent and that kids are graduating, you know, ready for to succeed in the economy. It might, if anything, what it might call for, rather than expanding accountability, is narrowing it. Mm-hmm. And saying, look, we're going to keep it very narrow. We're going to just show a couple indicators, reading and math, even though those don't account for everything. Mm-hmm. But just say, as long as you're hitting those measures, then the rest is up to you. Maybe in a perverse way, the best way to keep that kind of plurality is to keep the accountability narrow.
Yeah, I mean, just two quick points here. One is, you know, as I argued back in Common Sense School Reform, that the most useful way to think about accountability is as a floor. Accountability is actually a lousy mechanism for trying to reach a ceiling.
Yeah.
Because it has to be universal and encompassing. And the second thing is, to your point, that look, to my mind, it seems obvious that some families and some schools are going to care a lot more about basic measures of performance than others. In Washington, D.C., whether or not a school is getting basic performance in literacy and math matters a lot more than Fairfax County. Because for a lot of families in Fairfax County, they're like, we'll take care of that at home. We're looking for schools to offer our kids something else. So part of the challenge here is that it's not only a question of how expansive these indicators are, but for some families, you know, whose children are, depending on where their kids are in terms of proficiency, some indicators are actually more useful than others.
Okay, topic three.
For-profits in the digital learning sphere have come under attack this week. As the argument goes, they spend more on advertising than on ensuring quality products. What should the role of for-profits be in education?
Rick, you had a paper by John Bailey on this come out this week as well. What's your take on this? You think for-profits are getting a bad rap?
Yeah, they're getting a bad rap. I mean, you know, it's funny. We get excited when schools try to market themselves, when they print out their T-shirts, when they take out a billboard. This is supposed to be a big deal. It shows that they're being responsive. The fact that for-profits actually spend serious money trying to tell people that their product is good and why they should use it, it becomes bad. It's nuts.
You know, it's a similar argument you see in the pharmaceutical world, right? The sense that the reason that pharmaceuticals are so expensive is they're spending all this money on marketing, trying to get you to go to your doctor to ask for a certain brand of, instead of using the generic. I mean, I think there's something to that argument, right? That's not crazy. I mean, you know, especially when the public is paying, which is the case both with Medicare and with education, you get a sense of, hey, I don't want to be paying for all that marketing stuff.
Yeah, although it's interesting because in education, I mean, this is actually the flip side of the fact that we have no cost sensitivity. That it's not like parents are actually opting to imposing new services. That's actually what special ed community has done forever. We've taught parents through special ed to go agitate for new and more expensive provision for your kids. You know, and especially, I mean, I think the for-profits we're talking about are selling direct to consumers, aren't they? Or the ones that we were talking about this week.
This was a New York Times piece, and they were talking about, I thought it was a lot of higher ed stuff, but they're selling to schools. So if you're counting the consumer as the school,
okay. Then. No. Okay, so I'm thinking more. And like higher ed, obviously, right? Some of the complaints are that, you know, some of the proprietaries are marketing themselves directly to students and tricking these students into enrolling. And I'm like, well, at what point, are we going to expect aspiring students to take some responsibility for, you know, the decisions they're making?
So the big question is, look, can these companies bring value to education? And what they have going that the nonprofits don't is that they can scale, right? I mean, this is, we look at the CMOs, we know that we've got KIPP at 100 schools, and that's it, just 100 schools.
17 years in.
Right, 17 years in. You say, the only way you're going to get to scale is if you can raise capital in order to expand, and that's what the for-profit sector is good at.
It's partly capital, but it's also, partly the incentive structure is... You know, if you're running a mom and pop charter, you're doing it because you like being with your kids. You enjoy kind of the relationships. You start to grow that school. You start to add new campuses. It's actually less fun. What is it that offers? So, California community colleges this year are turning away 140,000 students who want to enroll. The president's talking about because they say the $2,600 tuition doesn't cover the real cost, because the real cost per pupil is about $10,000 by the time you take in the 75% of tuition that's actually state subsidized. The president says he wants more people to do college, but he's declaring war on the sector of higher ed, which is actually aggressively enrolling students, which is for profits. Now, they're enrolling students because they want to get more people in, because that's how they make money, and because they're, so are there real concerns here?
Right. So your point is, leave it to the community colleges. They have no incentive to expand, so they don't.
Invite in the for-profits. They have incentives to cut corners. And so really a lot of this becomes about what are the metrics and what are the how do you create a marketplace where people are actually shopping based on quality and performance?
Wow, Rick. Woo, you can tell we've been away for a couple of weeks. That was very substantive.
Kind of rusty.
Rusty, too, you think so?
I don't know, maybe not.
All right. Hey, we'll let you listeners decide. But up next is everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Although, really, we should be welcoming ourselves back to the show.
We should, and we should be telling the listeners that Amber has been promoted.
She has indeed. She is our new Vice President for Research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute.
Snazzy title, huh?
So she's not only that lady who does the Research Minute.
That's right.
She's a VEEP.
She's the Vice President of the Research Minute.
Nice.
Oh, the ladder I've climbed around here. It just brings tears to my eyes.
Maybe we should up it to a, Research Minute and a half. You could think about that.
Oh, no. Let's not go too far.
All right. Well, what are we talking about this week?
We got a new study out by NBR. This is Justine Hastings, Tom Kane, and others that examine the impact of a public school choice lottery system in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina. They're looking at post-secondary attainment here. Charlotte, Mecklenburg, as most of our listeners know, had an open enrollment policy instituted in 2002. Analysts matched district administrative records with data on college enrollment. The sample includes roughly 20,000 students. students. Data spans from 2000 to 2009. They use a value-added framework. In the end, they find that lottery winners from low-quality neighborhoods are more likely to graduate from high school, attend a four-year college, and earn a bachelor's degree. They are twice as likely to earn a degree from a top-tier institution. The analysts estimate that for these students, the impact of winning the lottery closes nearly 75% of the black-white gap in high school graduation rates and 25% of the gap in bachelor's degree completion. In short, for students from low-quality neighborhood schools, winning the lottery basically amounts to moving them from a low-quality to an average-quality school. They did a little bit of descriptive stats and show that those schools ironically had similar levels of resources and were managed very similarly. They find virtually no evidence of benefits for lottery winners from high-quality neighborhood schools. They didn't really kind of get into the black box. They hint at, you know, peer effects and school programming could be, you know, behind these gains. But interesting study.
Wow. And it should be noted that Charlotte Mecklenburg then ended that program soon after 2009, right?
That is true.
That is
true. And they're not, and they don't try to look at if there's any adverse consequences for the other, for other students who weren't in the lottery.
No,
right?
They did not.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, right, well, because, right, I mean, for me, two things here, right? One, obviously, peer effects mm-hmm. seems likely to be a huge part of the story. Two, it kind of suggests some of the limits with just trying to look at choice through looking at test scores. You know, parents give us those huge satisfaction numbers when their kids are in voucher programs, mm-hmm. even if the test scores are only modest. Even the task is really mm-hmm. modest. But maybe it's that parents are picking up on other things, behavioral changes, mm-hmm. attitudinal changes, which are going to actually have a real impact on life outcomes, mm-hmm. but may not show up in short-term math and reading scores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this is terrific and really interesting stuff.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, the attainment stuff is fascinating. And these are big effects. I mean, these lotteries make a huge mm-hmm. difference.
And they looked at attendance, too. That was also positive. There were some other variables I just didn't get into in my minute.
Look, it seems like this is going to bolster the case for folks like Rick Kahlenberg and others who are saying that we need to have these kinds of controlled choice programs around the country where kids, mm-hmm. Poor kids, minority kids, can go to school outside their neighborhood and have a shot at that. That, you know, going from a basically segregated school to an integrated school is having an impact mm-hmm. for them.
Although, I mean, again, this comes to some of the stuff we've been talking about of late, the stuff that Don Brewer did at Rand back mm-hmm. in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. that, you know, for instance, detracking seems to have positive effects for kids who would be in lower track classes, but negative effects mm-hmm. for kids mm-hmm. who have been in upper track classes.
Right.
Part of the story here, which we just don't look at, but would mm-hmm. be really interesting, is were there any adverse consequences for the kids in those schools who were not the lottery participants,
right,
or not. Mm-hmm. Just right. If you get these results and there's no negative effects mm-hmm. for the kids who lost out slots, mm-hmm. that's, you know, for those kids who lost spaces or for kids who are now in schools that accept these students, that's a really compelling story. Mm-hmm. If there are adverse consequences for those kids, it doesn't negate this stuff, but it does then put us yeah. in a position where we're talking about winners and losers.
Well, and that leads to the politics, which is that this program was ended because there was a lot of backlash from, you would imagine, the middle-class white parents who felt like, you know, they didn't always get to go to the school closest to them and that their mm-hmm. schools were now...
And especially if you paid a premium to buy into that neighborhood
right.
and folks who got a better bargain because they live in another neighborhood, mm-hmm. that gets mixed in with people who don't have any choice in the matter because they're living wherever the heck they can afford. But the reality is that, these people get portrayed in the national press as, you know, as mean-spirited SOBs who right. are locking out disadvantaged kids. But the reality is they bought a house because they wanted to take care of their kid. You know, let's make sure we're sufficiently empathetic to how they're coming at the issue.
All right. So,
all right, can I just put a plug? This is kind of wonky, but this was from the National Student Clearinghouse. Okay, do you guys know this?
Yeah.
I mean, so this is a brand new. Well, no, I don't know how long it's been, but it's a fairly new database that is really promising because it's now starting to track things that we've never been able to track before. So,
to know where these kids, what happens to these kids after high school, because and to start to figure out, you know, to what degree. Can, you know, do the test scores predict these outcomes? And we might decide that, you know, that test scores are not as predictive as we thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly better to be able to look at these life outcomes. Okay, what song goes
along? Song. So since we're talking about kids who've gotten a great opportunity to exit some poor schools, we have Can't You Hear Me Knockin' by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, you got satin shoes. Sleepy Joe.
I love the Rolling Stones. You know, I always thought that Rick Hess looked a little bit like Mick Jagger. You can ponder that, folks. But now it is time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat. Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes,
sir. All right, Chris, what you got for us this week?
All right, well, thanks to the folks at TNT, Law & Order seems to be on TV for no less than 18 hours a day. As a result, some people tend to, well, let's just say overindulge. I'm willing to bet that Laura Custodio, Dean of Porter Middle School in San Fernando Valley, is one of those people. After hearing that one of her 8th grade students was selling marijuana to other students, Dean Custodio sprang into action and set up a sting operation intended to catch the pot-slinging student red-handed. She gave a 7th grade student a $5 bill, marked $5 bill, with instructions to act as a decoy buyer. Talk about taking the law into one's own hands. What's up with that? Though the boy was scared to participate, Custodio told him it was the right thing to do and that he had to do it. The sting was to take place in the boy's bathroom, where a campus aide hid in the stall during the transaction. On the first attempt, the dealer refused to make the sale and told the decoy to meet him after school. Unsatisfied, Dean Custodio had the decoy pulled out of class a second time to try the sting operation again. This time, the dealer saw the campus aide and backed out on the deal. Though Custodio decided to call it quits after that, the decoy went on and made the purchase after class anyway, and returned, giving Custodio the newly purchased marijuana buds. I mean, what would she have done even if she did catch this kid red-handed? Place him under school arrest? Jump out and scream, gotcha? It doesn't make any sense. Why would she need to run a sting? Last time I checked, administrators didn't need to prove a student was guilty in court standards to suspend him or her. Eventually, the real authorities got involved. Custodio was transferred to a much less prominent position in the district, and the school's principal and vice principal retired. Oh yeah, and a court awarded the student used as a decoy a settlement worth over $1 million.
Whoa. Wow, you could buy a lot of pot with that.
Yeah.
I mean, all right, I got to ask you this question. A $5 bill? I mean, I don't know much about this, but doesn't pot cost a lot more than that?
I would imagine you're not getting that much. But then again, this is, you know, 7th, 8th graders. They're probably not dealing in, you know, massive quantities. It's probably
I just didn't
dime
have any
for
idea
dime
it was that cheap.
Whatnot.
I don't imagine
he got much.
Yeah. This is not the way to go. There are many other options for dealing with a situation like this, but it does make for a good story, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I don't know what was going through her mind, what she thought would, you know, result from running a successful sting operation.
Yeah. Well, I think the Law and Order assumption is a pretty good one. $1 million, gotta love taxpayer dollars going out the door for that. I don't know, that seems a little high, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I guess they played the student's story up pretty well. He came from a struggling neighborhood. He got into this new school district. He, you know, really started making it and doing well and succeeding. His parents were really proud of the success and the growth that they had seen in him. And the Dean Custodio kind of used him because she knew he was from a, you know, rough background and figured he would be a good person to be her decoy. So I'm sure they played that up and the jury said $1 million+.
Wow. What's up with that? All right. Well done this week. Thank you, Chris. That's all the time we've got. Till next week, I'm Mike Petrilli. Rick Hess has already left the building. We'll see you next time on the Education Gadfly Show.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.